Face the Nation, coming up next.
I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business, so I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 50-plus job sites, including Craigslist, LinkedIn, and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 200,000 businesses. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. That's ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ.
I'm Bob Schieffer, and today on Face the Nation, overnight news, a second case of Ebola confirmed in Dallas. Word this morning that a healthcare worker who treated Thomas Duncan has been diagnosed with Ebola. We'll get details from the head of the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Tom Frieden, House Homeland Security Chairman Michael McCaul, and we'll have a report from Liberia where U.S. troops are in place to help fight the deadly disease. We'll go to Iraq for the latest on the war with ISIS. We'll talk to former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, whose withering criticism of the president's strategy has stunned official Washington. Plus, an all-star panel, including Peggy Noonan of the Wall Street Journal, David Ignatius of the Washington Post, David Rode of Reuters, and Susan Page of USA Today. 60 years of news, because this is Face the Nation. And good morning again. We want to go first to Atlanta and the CDC director, Dr. Tom Frieden, for the latest on this new case of Ebola, which was confirmed in Dallas overnight. Doctor, thank you so much. The authorities at the hospital are saying that the person who has now been diagnosed as having Ebola was a healthcare worker. They don't give the gender, and was exposed to Duncan, the man who died down there, on his second visit to the hospital. Obviously, he was showing symptoms by then, but that the worker had been considered at that point in a low-risk situation, and they say he was following CDC protocols. In other words, wearing the gown, wearing the gloves, and all of that. Doesn't this make this even more serious than we thought it was?
We're deeply concerned about this new development with a preliminary positive in a healthcare worker who cared for the index patient in Dallas on multiple occasions after his diagnosis. I think the fact that we don't know of a breach in protocol is concerning because clearly there was a breach in protocol. We have the ability to prevent the spread of Ebola by caring safely for patients. The fact is that the individual who became ill was, as per protocol, self-monitoring. Immediately when they developed symptoms, they isolated themselves. They were promptly isolated at the hospital so that any further spread from that individual was stopped. And fundamentally, at this point, there are four things that we're doing. First is to make sure that that individual is cared for safely and effectively. Second, we're identifying that individual's contacts, and our CDC team lead for this investigation on the ground in Dallas interviewed that individual in detail. Third, we now consider all of the healthcare workers who cared for the index patient potentially to have been exposed, and we'll be rostering those individuals and determining which require active follow-up in addition to their self-monitoring. And fourth, we'll conduct a full investigation of what happens before health workers go in, what happens when they're there, and what happens in taking off their protective equipment, because infections only occur when there's a breach in protocol.
All right. Let me just make sure I understand what you're saying here. Are you saying that somehow or another, by accident or otherwise, that one of the protocols was violated or not followed? And that's how this happened, not because there are other ways that you can get this disease. Is that basically what you're saying, doctor?
That's correct. We know from many years of experience that it's possible to care for patients with Ebola safely without risk to healthcare workers. But we also know that it's hard, that even a single breach can result in contamination. And one of the areas that we look at closely are things like how you take off the gear that might be infected or contaminated. Another that we'll be looking at closely in the investigation is the interventions that were done to try desperately to keep the index patient alive. This included dialysis and intubation. These are two procedures which can result in the spread of infectious material.
And how many of these workers are you now monitoring, doctor?
We're now looking at all individuals who cared for the index patient, and we'll be determining how many of those may potentially have had contact that would have resulted in a breakdown of protocol and possible contamination.
But, I mean, approximately, is that 24 people? Is that 10 people? How many people are you monitoring down there at that hospital?
Yeah. I can't give you an exact number. These are late-breaking developments. We got the preliminary positive test last night, less than 12 hours ago, late last night, and our team is intensively working with the hospital on both understanding what happened, identifying other healthcare workers who may be at risk, and also making sure that protocols are followed in the care of this individual.
Doctor, let me ask you this, and I'm asking you just because I'd be interested in it. No, it seems that the authorities are being very secretive, as if they were dealing with top secret information or something like that. I just wonder, there must be a reason for that.
I don't think we're being secretive at all. Within 2 hours of the index patient being diagnosed, we had a press conference. Late last night, we heard of this patient's preliminary positive, and we're speaking to the press now. We want to give more rather than less information.
I understand.
We also want to make sure the information we give is accurate.
I don't mean this as criticism, but I mean the fact that you can't even tell if it's a man or a woman. There must be a reason that you're withholding that information.
You know, we really try to protect individual patient confidentiality. So sometimes that may seem excessive, but if you were sick or a family member were sick, you'd really want the information coming from the individual or family. There may be coworkers who would be able to identify who the individual is if they knew the gender. So, you know, we would rather err on the side of safety and the side of respecting and protecting patients.
Doctor, thank you very much. And we certainly appreciate your taking your time to talk with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Officials at that hospital in Dallas have also announced they are shutting down the emergency room there until further notice.
We have put the emergency department at Presbyterian on diversion until further notice because of limitations in staffed capacity. That means ambulances are not currently bringing patients to our emergency department.
There are also reports, as I alluded to in the interview with Dr. Frieden, that the healthcare worker, the identity of that person is that she is a female nurse. We're going to go to the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, Michael McCaul, who is in Austin this morning. Mr. Chairman, you held hearings down there. Let me ask you about that first. Have you been able to confirm, is this a female nurse who was infected?
We have confirmation that it was a nurse at Dallas Presbyterian. I don't know the gender of the nurse, probably most likely female. But, this really raises the issue of protocols and proper protocols and procedures. Remember, Mr. Duncan, when he was first admitted, said he came from Liberia, had a 103-degree temperature, and then was released onto the streets, which also causes a threat to other people out in the community. And so we believe that the hearing that was brought out with CDC and Homeland Security officials and state and locals, that they need to start following better protocols. And I'm very saddened to hear about the nurse being exposed as well, because as I understand, the nurse was wearing the protective gear, and there must have been some breach of that protocol.
Well, it sounds as if, like, for example, that this may have happened when this nurse was taking off the gloves
right.
that they wear or something of that nature. But clearly, it does underline the sensitivity. Our Dr. John LaPook, who's going to be with us later in the broadcast, has been talking to officials at the CDC, and he tells us that they are now considering sending Ebola patients to just one of the four designated facilities in Emory, at Emory in Atlanta, at NIH, at Montana, and in Nebraska. Do you think that's a wise step there, if they should do that? Is that necessary?
I think that may be wise because they're best, they have the expertise to deal with this very horrific virus. Five cases. Mr. Duncan passed away, unfortunately, and now we have a new case. And so I do think that's important. And also it's important that we eliminate the source or threat at the source. And the source really is in Africa, where it's spreading like a wildfire. We have now over 8,000 cases of Ebola spreading throughout Africa and West Africa, 4,000 deaths. And I think there's a lot of talk about banning flights. I think we need to target more the individual themselves and look at the idea of potentially temporarily suspending the 13,000 visas that would be coming out of this region, allowing healthcare workers to go in because they have to contain the threat. But then when it comes to the sort of the original population out of West Africa leaving, I think until this gets under control, that's a measure that policymakers ought to be looking at.
Well, we have, as you well know, started screening at five airports now in this country, where most of the passengers from those three West African countries come from. Do you think that's going to help?
Well, I think it will help a great deal. We do screen at the point of origin and then the point of entry within the United States in the top five airports where they would potentially come through. They are secondarily screened automatically if they come from the country of origin, and a Coast Guard medical officer will do an evaluation, including a temperature analysis. Now, this is a virus that incubates for 21 days, so that still leaves the possibility that somebody could actually still get through that process.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to have a lot more on Ebola in the second half of our broadcast. I want to thank you for joining us this morning. We will also have a report from Liberia, by the way. But we want to turn now to the other big story, the war against ISIS. CBS News correspondent Elizabeth Palmer is in Baghdad this morning with the latest on that. We'll have more on Ebola in our second half hour, including a report from Liberia. But we want to turn now to the other big story, the war against ISIS. CBS News correspondent Elizabeth Palmer is in Baghdad with the latest on that.
ISIS is now on the attack in a kind of half circle around Baghdad, from the north around to the west and down to the south. At the closest point, their fighters are in an outer suburb called Abu Ghraib, which is about 8 miles from the perimeter of Baghdad International Airport. There are now 12 teams of American military advisors on the ground with the Iraqi forces who are charged with protecting the capital. And America is also carrying out airstrikes nearby, mainly to the west and to the south. Now, nobody expects a major assault on the city anytime soon, but it's likely ISIS will keep up the pressure with a bombing campaign by slipping through the many army and police checkpoints in the city, and even civilian security checks that have been set up in all public places, including in mosques. In fact, yesterday, more than 30 people were killed in three separate bomb attacks. Now, outside the city, ISIS is in control of some major sections of highway and also key towns. The Iraqi security forces fighting them are holding their own, but only just. There have certainly been no major victories in the past few days.
All right. Elizabeth Palmer reporting from Baghdad this morning. Thanks, Liz. And joining us now, the former Secretary of Defense, the former CIA Director Leon Panetta. His new book is just out. It is called Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership in war and peace. Mr. Secretary, we're glad to have you.
Nice to be here, Bob.
You just heard, Elizabeth. Do you think Baghdad is actually in danger of coming under attack now?
I don't think we can take anything for granted with ISIS. They're moving against Kobani on the Syrian-Turkish border. They're moving in Anbar province, as we've seen. This is a well-trained, a well-armed, and frankly, they are well-commanded in terms of their ability to conduct war. And I think we just have to be very aware that they represent a significant threat.
We have now been conducting airstrikes for, 9 weeks? And yet, as you say, they continue to advance. In some ways, they seem stronger rather than weaker. Is this strategy working?
This is a strategy that is going to demand a lot of patience. I think the president has taken the right steps. We've got troops to try to help the Iraqis get their act together in terms of their security force. We're conducting these airstrikes. We're trying to train and arm the rebels in Syria. We've built a coalition force. But all of this requires great leadership on the part of the United States. We're going to have to keep this together, and we're going to have to be very patient. We're going to have to be very determined. These airstrikes can help to a degree. I think they've helped kind of stifle some of the momentum in ISIS. But to make these airstrikes work, you've got to have information on targets, and you've got to be able to pinpoint where the enemy is located. And that's something, frankly, that's going to take time.
Basically, what you're saying, we have to have some kind of people on the ground here.
You've got to have boots on the ground. Maybe it doesn't have to be American boots on the ground, but you have got to have people on the ground who can identify targets and who can help us develop the kind of effective airstrikes that are going to be needed if we're going to be able to undermine, destroy this vicious enemy that we're dealing with.
The president's national security advisor, Susan Rice, was on television this morning, and she said, if I understand it, there has been no recommendation from military commanders that the United States put combat troops in Iraq. Does that sound right to you?
Well, the one thing I know about our military commanders is they are going to be looking at every possibility of how we effectively deal with ISIS. And I don't know what recommendations they've made or not made, but I will say this. I think the President of the United States has to be open to whatever recommendations are made in order to ensure that we are effective in going after ISIS.
She said flatly this morning, we are not going to get involved in a ground war in Iraq. We are not going to put troops in there. Should she be ruling that out?
I've always felt that the President of the United States ought to keep every option available in dealing with this kind of enemy. It doesn't mean that we need to invade. It doesn't mean we have to, as Susan Rice said, have combat troops on the ground. But I think you want to protect every possible option because we are dealing with a very resilient enemy. And the only way you deal with a resilient enemy is with flexibility, adaptability, and the kind of determination that we're going to need if we're ever going to win this war.
We're going to take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more about this in just a minute.
Cloud may be just another overused buzzword, but the cloud is an effective computing environment that can save your business time and money. Barracuda Networks is no stranger to the cloud. In fact, all of our security and storage solutions connect to the cloud for continuous updates and offsite redundancy. Barracuda's cloud also plays host to our email security, web security, file sharing, and e-signing services. We even offer solutions on Amazon's AWS and Microsoft's Azure public cloud platforms. To try any of our cloud-connected solutions free, visit barracuda.com/cloud.
Guys, if you're into fantasy football, you've got to check out FanDuel.com. At FanDuel, you play in one-week fantasy football leagues for real money with immediate cash payouts. You only play when you want, and you can change your team any week. FanDuel's paying out over $10 million every week this season. And right now, FanDuel is giving you up to $200 free. That's right. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200. Just go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone in the upper right corner, and enter code FOOTBALL70. FANDUEL.com. Code FOOTBALL, the number 70.
Back now with Leon Panetta. Mr. Panetta, in your book, you talked about how the dysfunction that is now set in Washington. You also talked about how control has been so centralized in the White House that cabinet officers, including the Secretary of Defense, sometimes were told not to deal with Congress, for example, that all of those things would be handled in the White House. What's gone wrong here in this administration? I mean, for one thing, they can't seem to catch a break here. And is it their fault? Is it just what's happened? What's the problem?
Bob, there are, having been in this town close to 50 years, You know, I've seen Washington at its best and Washington at its worst. And right now, I think it's Washington at its worst because of the gridlock and the stalemate that's involved in this town. A lot of things have contributed to it. But I worry about that. And that's really one of the reasons in the book I try to identify my concerns, because we're looking, regardless of what happens at this election, at probably 2.5 more years of stalemate. If that happens at a time when we're facing the kind of crises we're facing abroad, at a time when we're facing major issues in this country, there's a certain sense that both parties have kind of given up on going after those issues and dealing with them. And this country cannot tolerate another 2.5 years of stalemate. The president can't tolerate it. If he wants to be able to get the things done that he wants done, and I respect him for what he wants to get done, he has got to get into the ring. Everybody's got to get in and fight to make sure that we do the right thing for the country.
Well, what do you think? There are some suggestions that he might be considering some major staff changes after the election. You think that'd be a good idea to just kind of clean house and start over? Other presidents have done this in the second term.
I always think it's a good idea to bring new life into the White House. The problem with the White House, is, as you mentioned, is isolation. You isolate the president from a broad range of views. And I understand this has developed over the years, more concentration of power in the staff of the White House. And as a result, the president doesn't get exposed to a broad range of views that he needs in order to make the decisions. So bringing new life in, bringing new views in, would be very helpful to giving the president that greater exposure to a lot of different options that he's going to have to consider if he's going to get things done.
You say in the book that sometimes he doesn't seem to show the passion that one needs to show, that he approaches things as a law professor.
Yeah. I don't mind presidents who have the quality of a law professor and looking at the issues and determining just exactly, you know, what needs to be done. But presidents need to also have the heart of a warrior. That's the way you get things done, is you engage in the fight. And in this town, as difficult as it is, and it is difficult, I mean, you've got Tea Party members in Congress who basically want to shut the government down and tear it down. He still has to have the ability to engage and to try to work with people up there who want to get things done in order to make sure that we just don't stalemate as a country. This country is strong. It's powerful. I think we could have a great future. But if all we do is operate by crisis after crisis after crisis, then we are going to weaken this country.
Wall Street Journal reported Friday that the president is now preparing options for closing down Guantanamo and doing it by executive order. That would be doing it without Congress's approval. Good idea, bad idea right now?
But I think the president was right to want to close Guantanamo. I respected that. And frankly, we took steps to try to do that. Congress put a barriers to that. But this is a big step. And if it's going to be done right, I think the president has to engage with the Congress in trying to provide the kind of transition that's necessary to make it work right. We're in another war. We're going to be getting enemy combatants. We've got to think about how we're going to deal with all of that. And the only way to do that is working together on what is a major issue that is going to have to be confronted.
Leon Panetta, it's always a pleasure to
have you. Nice to be with you, Bob.
Thank you so much. How many times can you say it was another awful week? I've lost count, but it was another awful week. Two cases of Ebola, one fatal, have now been confirmed on U.S. soil, and ISIS is on the move in northern Iraq and Syria. American warplanes were in the air again, but it was hard to judge their impact. And now the United States and its ally Turkey are at odds over how to confront the terrorists. The stock market had a bad week, and China finally passed the United States as the world's largest economy. Not surprising, then, that a Chinese company bought the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, the iconic New York landmark where Henry Kissinger entertained Chinese officials when the two countries first resumed talking back in the 70s. Now the Chinese own it. I guess this is just another example of the interlocking global economy, but with Russian billionaires buying up New York's luxury apartments and now this, somehow it makes me a little sad. I've got to believe it's not what Rogers and Hart had in mind when they wrote that great old song that says, "We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx, and Staten Island, too, It's lovely going through the zoo. No, they'd be surprised by all of this, but it is a great song, and we still own the zoo. Back in a minute.
Guys, if you're into fantasy football, you've got to check out FanDuel.com. At FanDuel, you play in one-week fantasy football leagues for real money with immediate cash payouts. You only play when you want, and you can change your team any week. FanDuel's paying out over $10 million every week this season. And right now, FanDuel is giving you up to $200 free. That's right. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200. Just go to FanDuel.com, click their microphone in the upper right corner, and enter code FOOTBALL70. FANDUEL.com. Code FOOTBALL, the number 70.
And welcome back to Face the Nation. We want to get an update first on the condition of the Dallas Ebola patient, the new patient. CBS News correspondent Vicente Arenas is outside Texas Health Presbyterian. Vicente?
Good morning, Bob. Less than 90 minutes after that worker detected they had a fever, they ended up here at Texas Health Presbyterian. We're told that nurse is now in stable condition. The Texas Department of Health conducted the initial tests here, and now the Centers for Disease Control must confirm the diagnosis. The name of the worker is not being released, and a spokesman says the worker came into contact with Thomas Eric Duncan during his second visit here. Duncan died from the virus last week. The worker, who is now tested positive, we are told was wearing full protective gear, including a gown, glove, mask, and a shield. A spokesman said he was very concerned that a worker could still become infected even with all this protection. The worker had been under a self-monitoring regimen prescribed by the CDC, and 48 people are in what's considered a self-monitoring pool. Part of that process includes checking themselves for temperatures or for a fever at least a couple of times a day. And as I mentioned, less than 90 minutes after this nurse did that, then it appeared at Texas Health Presbyterian. The worker was in what is considered a low-risk pool and had not been to work in at least a couple of days. Bob?
All right. Thank you so much, Vicente. U.S. forces have now arrived in West Africa to help fight the Ebola epidemic. CBS News reporter Deborah Panta is in Monrovia, Liberia, and here is her report.
The death toll from Ebola has reached 4,000, but experts here in Liberia warn that it is probably much higher, as there are still many unreported cases. Community awareness is key to halting the spread of the infection, but Western support is also crucial. Last week, another group of soldiers arrived in Monrovia. They are being deployed around the country by General Darrell Williams from an emergency operations center at a beachfront hotel ballroom. The Liberian government has welcomed the U.S. presence in Liberia, but there has also been criticism that this is too little too late.
Well, what you need to understand, Deborah, is that the government of Liberia, the ambassador's leadership, AID, the UN, CDC, a host of other non-government organizations have been here for some time dealing with this. And so we were brought in to provide our unique capability, logistics, engineering, training to fill a gap.
And in terms of filling that gap, do you think you can reverse the trend?
Yeah, so it's a whole of government approach, and we're just filling that small gap. The U.S. military is not here to solve Ebola.
The U.S. military has already set up mobile testing labs, which can cut the time down to confirm whether a sick person actually has Ebola from several days to several hours. This will free up beds a lot more quickly. A short drive away, a 150-bed U.S.-funded Ebola treatment unit is under construction. It will double the capacity to deal with the disease. But now there is a new concern. Liberian health workers are threatening a slowdown on Monday. They want danger pay and safer working conditions. The government says it is doing everything it can to resolve the dispute quickly, but aid organizations are concerned that a potential strike could severely set back Ebola containment at this critical juncture.
All right, CBS News reporter Deborah Panta in Liberia this morning. Our chief medical correspondent, Dr. John LaPook, is here with me. Doctor, I want to get back to this, what they're calling a breach of the protocol. What does that mean? It sounds like, as they describe it, we've now confirmed it was a nurse, that somehow or another, all the things that the nurse was supposed to do, apparently the nurse made some sort of mistake, maybe taking off the gloves. What do you read into this?
Well, it says to me that you really have to rethink where exactly these patients who are diagnosed with Ebola should go in the best of circumstances. Mm-hmm. So there, as you pointed out earlier, there are four medical centers around the country that are specifically set up for these high-risk infections. And they're in Emory, Nebraska, NIH, and Montana. And of the six patients who had Ebola treated in America, now there are seven, I guess, three of them were at Emory, two at Nebraska. In Emory and Nebraska, two of these high-risk centers, they're specifically trained to deal with it. No healthcare worker has been infected. And so I asked the first thing this morning, I reached out to Tom Frieden, who's the head of the CDC, and I said, what about considering, you know, an abundance of caution? Of course, every hospital has to be able to diagnose it, but once you're diagnosed, being sent there. So I just got this back a few minutes ago, and this is what I heard back from the CDC. The developments in Dallas are caused to double down on all our efforts to make sure healthcare workers and hospitals are properly trained and that they meticulously follow guidelines while triaging potential Ebola patients or providing care to Ebola patients. Any hospital across the U.S. must be prepared. However, as we continue our outreach efforts, it may be a prudent measure to suggest certain hospitals which have specifically trained personnel and which have exercised their Ebola response plans thoroughly be prepared to receive first. So I'm reading this as saying, yeah, that may be a good idea to, once you have a diagnosed patient, move them to these high risk.
To these four.
Well, and they run through
hospitals.
The drills, you know, in fairness to places like Dallas and places all over the country. We have not run through these drills in the way that these high risk centers have. So when do you make the mistakes? The first couple of times you see the
Well,
patients?
I mean, is it your surmise, and it can't be anything more at this point, that maybe what happened, this worker, this nurse took off the gloves or something, and that's how this was passed
on?
You don't think this means there's some new mysterious way that we didn't know about before?
No, and I know Dr. Frieden said the same thing, and this is a great time not to have magical thinking. There's 40 years of experience treating Ebola. We know how it's transmitted. There's no evidence from a huge New England Journal review a couple of weeks ago that this virus is any different than any of the previous viruses, that it's mutating or anything like that. We know that to protect the community, it's a public health measure. So the individual patient sadly died in this case. But what protects the community is the public health system, isolating the person, making sure you track down their contacts. And I have to say, after some missteps at the beginning where the apartment wasn't clean, people weren't moved out, the healthcare system did a very good job responding to this. And in fact, it took only 48 hours for the CDC to track down all 48 contacts.
We have to move on. But let me just ask you this. My sense of it is probably dialysis might be the most dangerous part of this test.
I agree with you. When I heard, and people were saying they didn't do a full out effort, when I heard that they gave him dialysis, that involves a lot, probably people here have not seen what that involves, a lot of body fluids. You're filtering the blood, and also intubation when they put in a breathing tube. So that meant they were going all out, and there is a potential to get exposed to fluids when you're doing these dangerous procedures.
Okay. Dr. John Lapote, thanks so much. Time now for some analysis on all of this. Peggy Noonan, a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, David Ignatius, columnist for the Washington Post, and we have Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, Susan Page, and David Rode of Reuters. Peggy, you said you found Secretary Panetta's book obnoxious.
Yes, I did.
What did you think of his performance today?
Non-obnoxious. Actually, I thought it was, he said something important that gathered together some thoughts in his book, and he said words that I think are going to prove to be memorable. A president needs the heart of a warrior. A president needs someone to feel passion and execute plans in a very personal and on-the-job and focused way. So I think he made that point rather strikingly. He also made his points about ISIS and the possible need for boots on the ground over there. I found the book itself to be obnoxiously partisan. And frankly, ultimately unhelpful in that way. I always want the older and more accomplished and impressive members of our government, when they come forward and rightly share their thoughts and books and memoirs, I always want them to be a little above the battle and appreciative of those they've had arguments with. So I don't feel I saw enough of that, but I thought he was impressive today.
I frankly don't agree with you on the first part of your analysis. I thought it was, I found the book very helpful. David, what did you think of it?
I thought we were seeing the real Leon Panetta. He is a passionate man when he said that the president needs to have the heart of a warrior, when he said he needs to get in the ring and fight. That's Leon Panetta talking. But I think he does believe this is Barack Obama's last chance to be a decisive president. I think that's one explanation for this book that struck so many people as a kind of assault on the president in the White House. Panetta believes deep down that it's crucial the president respond. He said one other thing that struck me today, which was the need for patience. This strategy has really just been out there a month. It's going to take some months to train up the people who can do the fighting in Iraq and in Syria to make the strategy work. And I did hear Panetta, this strong, experienced voice saying, be patient. Wait for this to go forward. And I think he's saying people will be patient if they feel they have a strong, decisive, warrior president who's telling them he knows what he's doing.
You know, as we were putting together this broadcast, and this, you know, you always have to do what do we put first? Do we do this or do we do that? And it occurs to me that both of these stories are really about national security in a very different way, but really both about the health and security of the American people.
And, you know, I think both these stories, the Ebola virus and the threat from ISIS, are feeding into a sense that a lot of Americans have that the world is not only a dangerous place, but that the government is not competent to handle it. I mean, even the Secret Service controversy, I think, contributes to that sense. I think that's a very dangerous thing for President Obama, the sense that, that his administration is not competent to protect the American people. That is the most fundamental job of a U.S. president. And I think it's a big factor in the midterm elections. I think it is increasingly, that set of issues are contributing to a sense that Republicans in particular are trying to tap as we go into these final weeks before the election.
Do you get the sense that maybe Congress ought to be in town dealing with all of this? I mean, people say, well, it's an election year. I always go back to 1964. They did some pretty important things in 1964, including passing the Civil Rights Bill. Why isn't the Congress here?
That's a good question. I agree there's sort of a growing, you know, feeling that the government can't handle this. One other trend that we saw, we just did this special report this week at Reuters, the White House is centralizing decision-making. We looked at Syria, but it's happened, and we talked about this earlier, both Republican and Democratic presidents are trying to control things. And you can't do that in a world where in one summer you have an Ebola crisis, you have the Russians going into Ukraine, and you have this new crisis in Syria. You've got to delegate to the CDC, the Pentagon, you know, Secretary Panetta, and the State Department more. And our politics are so savage, frankly, and unrelenting that presidents kind of get in this bunker mentality, and that's what we're seeing.
But, I mean, if ever there were a case where everybody should come together and recognize we got a real problem here, I think it would be this Ebola situation. Mm. You can disagree or agree on whether airstrikes are helping. But, I mean, a disease, you know, the possibility that we may have, you know, some sort of epidemic. I don't think we're anywhere close to that right now, but we could have. One would think that that is where the two sides would come together, Peggy.
Yeah, it shouldn't by any means be a political argument or a partisan one. Susan mentioned the word competence, that there's an anxiety about the government being competent to handle these real assaults, Ebola, ISIS, et cetera. It seems to me part of the competence question is connected to the word candor. I do think the American people hear the government talk, and it incessantly talks, and it talks in a concentrated way from a few people in the White House as they hold on to their sort of concentrated power. But there is a lack of a sense in so many of these stories that you are getting it straight, that they are telling you really what they know, that they're telling you what you can do. There's always a sense, especially with the Ebola thing, that they're trying to keep you calm. And it has that patronizing sound of, we don't want you little people to get nervous. Look, nobody wants the American public to get nervous, but we would all be less nervous if we had a sense we were getting it straight from our governmental bodies.
No, I think people do want to hear the truth. I'm struck. I read something this week that said the virus is multiplying on virus time. You know, it just grows exponentially. It's 1,000, then it's 2,000, then it's 4,000, then it's 8,000, and our response is growing on program time, on bureaucratic time, on political time, and there's a mismatch. There are two clocks, and one's running really fast, and the other's running normal speed. Now, I don't think that this has been politicized, thank goodness. I do think that government officials are worried about panicking the country, which is not a crazy fear given some of the responses you see. So I think they need to be careful. They don't want to talk down to people. They want to be candid, but they need to be careful not to fuel a public panic. So, but I think that the deeper problem is until you get the two clocks in sync and then slow virus time, this is really going to look like it's out of control.
But if they don't seem more candid, I mean, I understand your point about panic, but they have to seem like they are telling the truth by telling the truth. Then there will be no paranoia and sense of, oh, we're not getting it straight, they're not telling us. It's really a part of keeping people calm is being candid with them.
So maybe we need more Leon Panettas who are candid. You know, lots of criticism this week of Leon Panetta for writing a book that's critical of a president still in office. It seemed to me that, number one, Leon Panetta has a long history. If you ask him a question, he gives you the answer of what he thinks, which is just the kind of thing that gives people reassurance in their government. The second thing is Leon Panetta makes the point that there's still one-fourth of Barack Obama's presidency to go. His presidency is not over. We've got more than two years. And I think he's making the case that it is possible to change course on some of these things that have been so problematic, on the centralization of power that David talks about, on the failure to listen to other points of views and sometimes to kind of talk an issue to death instead of acting decisively. And that seemed to me to be part of his motivation.
David, you were about to say.
Just that what we got, the feedback from administration officials as we were doing the story, is that there's a feeling, both for George W. Bush and Barack Obama's staff, that the smallest of mistake is going to be pounced on by your political opponents, and they're just going to ravage you. And that the nature of our politics, and they also frankly complain about the media, the 24/7 onslaught, the instant need for an instant position, it's very hard for them to handle. And they're afraid of taking risk, and I think that's very bad for our system, you know, in the long term.
David, you wrote a column this week suggesting, and I must say I'm sort of hearing the same thing, but not from any great sources, but that the president may be looking at making some staff changes after the election. He would not be the first president who did this about halfway into his second
term. No, well, in fact, Leon Panetta is a perfect example of how a president who's in real trouble. Bill Clinton was in terrible trouble in 1994. His White House was a mess. He had a very nice, genial man named Mac McClarty who was presiding over chaos. And he brought in Leon Panetta, who cracked the whip and said, everybody reports to the president through me, and that's it. There's going to be no more separate deals. And the Clinton White House began to calm down. So it shows what you can do. George W. Bush did it just the same way with Josh Bolten in his second term. So I think this White House is thinking, we have two more years. How do we get enough bandwidth, enough intellectual capital to deal with what we know are huge problems? We've been talking about them, ISIS, Ebola, and that's just a beginning, China. And so I think they're looking. I think they're trying to think, who are the people who would help? Bring in General John Allen, a retired Marine general, widely respected, is described to me as the first sign of what you'll see a lot more of after the November election.
And we would also add that Ronald Reagan made some significant changes in his White House.
Wholesale, during and after Iran-Contra, oh my goodness, he sort of, everybody got canned, and very serious and substantive people took their jobs, and these were people who could push back very seriously against anything they didn't like. I understand what everybody's saying about maybe the president will make personnel changes. I rarely disagree with that, but my sense is, as David says, if you don't change the procedures that are not working, it's not going to matter so much that you,
what do you mean?
New people. If everything is coming out of the White House and the executive agencies are lacking autonomy and freedom and become therefore passive vessels with names of subjects like energy, etc. If it is left like that, even a change of personnel won't work. If the president eases up and lets the agencies come back, help develop policy, give people outside a very small circle a voice, that will help him.
Does the president simply need to talk to more people?
I think he needs to talk to more people, and he needs to talk to more people who will talk back to him. And one of the things we've seen is that the people with the greatest standing to talk back to him have left. You know, Hillary Clinton, Bob Gates, Leon Panetta, and they've been replaced by and large with people who are tend to be more loyal to those people whose stature comes from him. So I think that makes him more reluctant to disagree with him when he might be considering a big decision. And, you know, besides the problems he's facing, he's going to have a different Senate, a different Congress, most likely, after the November midterms. He is likely to have a Republican-controlled Senate. And that's going to be something, I think, that propels, as well, changes in the administration to try to make these last 2 years something that really counts.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. You agree? Republican-controlled Senate?
I think he'll. George W. Bush got shellacked in, you know, the 2006 election and made major changes as well. The president needs to talk to more people. He also needs to delegate more. But again, when we brought up sort of specific issues, we had someone, a former White House official, say that they admitted that White House now watches embassy security worldwide in the wake of Benghazi. And obviously there's a huge, you know, controversy about Benghazi. They see it as an honest mistake where they let the State Department handle it and a tragic event happened. And they said, we cannot delegate, but I think they need to delegate and they need to sort of fire people if things go wrong. The president's been hesitant to, you know, clean house. He should delegate and remove people if they don't do their job.
Quickly, David.
I think the president will be wise to bring in some prominent Republicans among the new talent that he brings in after the November elections. He's likely to face a Republican House and Senate. He's got to deal with that reality. And if he's going to govern amidst crisis, he needs some allies around him who will help him get something accomplished.
All right. Well, thanks to all of you. Finally, today, in an interview for CBS This Morning, State Department correspondent Margaret Brennan sat down with Ed and Paula Kassig, the parents of American hostage Peter Kassig, who, after converting to Islam, now goes by Abdul Rahman Kassig. Margaret asked them about their efforts to bring their son home.
We're hoping that, if not directly, word will get to him indirectly that we're doing everything we can to secure his release.
Have his captors asked for anything?
No. They demand. They simply demand.
And their demands have always been ones that we cannot accommodate.
It's just beyond what's reasonable in terms of money, in terms of your power?
Right. In both cases, yes. And we have sent them back messages that we cannot do what you ask. We have tried, but we don't have the power to do it. Please be merciful. He is your brother. He is your brother in the faith.
There'll be more of Margaret's interview tomorrow on CBS This Morning. And that's all the time we have for today. We want to thank you for watching Face the Nation. We'll see you next week. Today's guests were former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, CDC Director Dr. Thomas Frieden, and Congressman Michael McCaul. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Rob Hinden. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stocky-Wayne. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Google+, and Facebook.